Couch Potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. Today's new movies I'm going to be talking about include Alpha, Mile 22, Crazy Rich Asians, and a follow-up on The Meg. I'll also be talking about some news, the trailer park, and the home cinema roundup featuring Avengers Infinity War. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
First piece of news I wanted to talk about is, you have to say a rest in peace to Aretha Franklin. She passed away this week at the age of 76. That is a huge loss for the music world. And while I don't really cover music, she certainly had left an impact culturally throughout America, and not even just in music, but in movies. One of the best ways that movie fans have been remembering her this week has been through the Blues Brothers. If you remember that film from 1980, directed by John Landis, and of course starring John Belushi and Dan Aykroyd. But it also was well known for bringing out a lot of music stars. It had Cab Calloway do a bit. He performed Minnie the Moocher in the film. But Aretha Franklin, she of course played the wife of one of their friends at a diner, and throws into a Think tribute song. And this is one of the greatest soul singers ever, and had such a great range and such a great voice. And she's one of those people that you kind of grow up knowing. I grew up and she was just part of the atmosphere. She was part of the world in terms of being such a well-known singer. I would say, you know, maybe Ella Fitzgerald was close to her as well, but Aretha Franklin was such a legend, even during her own time. And that's something that she kept up for many years. So yeah, she will be missed, and we have to give a final rest in peace to Aretha Franklin. The next piece of news I want to talk about is something that's a little bit old. I guess it kind of happened late last week. And that is the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences has announced a new category for the Oscars. And this is an interesting choice, how they did it. I'm not surprised that they're doing something like this, but it's an interesting choice of how they're doing it. And that is the category of Outstanding Achievement in Popular Film. Now, this is, I believe, a very direct response to the often criticized Oscars, because they always have art films and significant movies. And every year, because I talk about the Oscars every year on the radio, and I'm always getting asked, well, the box office doesn't match the contenders. And every now and then you get something like when Avatar was nominated, or when Titanic was nominated. And even something like Gladiator, you know, movies that win Best Picture that are bona fide $100 million plus movie hits are oftentimes focused on, but it's not uncommon to have the spread of films and the movies only making $15, $20 million, you know, maybe getting more after the big award season push that you get, but likely making more now on home video. I mean, you have some movies like Get Out last year that was nominated, that was a big hit, but you also had movies like Lady Bird, which did well, but it wasn't, you know, it was nowhere near $500 million movie like some of the other films that are out there. And this is the Academy trying to stay relevant, because the viewership is going down, interest in the Oscars going down. I don't think that has anything to do with the subject matter that they're picking, because they've always picked artsy-fartsy movies. The problem with the Oscars is it's a 4.5-hour ceremony that nobody needs to sit and watch anymore, and it's just filled with fluff and garbage. I DVR the thing every year, and then I go back and I watch the relevant moments. It takes me an hour and a half. Anybody with a smartphone or an internet connection and a computer can find out in real time what's happening at the Oscars, so the watching of the ceremony is unnecessary. Now, to that extent, they have also just said they're going to trim down the ceremony to just 3 hours. Still, 3 hours! Make it an hour and a half, let Ricky Gervais be the host with no supervision and no vetting of his jokes, and just let it go. And then you'll get people to watch it. I'm sort of split on this because the whole thing is like for this year, they're going to say, oh, well, you know, the Mission Impossible 6 could get nominated for best, you know, outstanding achievement in popular film, or even Black Panther, which I think, if anything, this kills Black Panther's chance for a best picture nomination. Although I thought that that was a slim to none chance anyways. I mean, this is the Academy ultimately tipping its hat and saying, yes, we're not going to pick blockbusters. Even though they every now and then try to throw one in the nominations, like Mad Max Fury Road, which wasn't as, you know, certainly wasn't the biggest movie of that year, but it fit that blockbuster status. Is it a good thing? Is it a bad thing? I don't know. I'm indifferent to it myself because I don't think it is a good thing or a bad thing. I think it's the Oscars desperately trying to stay relevant, but I also don't think you need to equate best movie or good, even quality movie with box office. If that were the case, then the Transformers movies would be the best movies ever made, and those things certainly aren't. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first one I want to hit really quickly, I'm going to do it out of order, is What Men Want, which opens on January 11th.
I'm so sick of this boys' club. Every day
is pipe day. You don't connect well with men.
I know someone you should talk to.
I can help you connect with men. Why don't we have some tea?
I feel weird after last night.
Yeah, that's what happens when tequila meets desperation.
Okay, stop saying things you shouldn't be saying to your boss.
Holy crap, can you hear my inner thoughts?
Weren't you complaining about men trying to keep you down?
First of all, some of the scariest things you're ever going to see on the big screen are the terms coming this January or coming in September. Because those dates are some of the most notoriously terrible times for movies. Occasionally you'll get a good horror movie dropping at that time, but usually September, like Labor Day frame, and especially right that first 2 weeks of January, when it's a January release and not something that's spilling over from award season or something that goes wide in January, even though it was released on December 21st in New York and LA. What Men Want looks passable. It's a remake, essentially, of What Women Want, the one with Mel Gibson, where he could read women's minds. To me, What Men Want, it's not all that interesting because you just walk around and guys would be like, I'd like to have sex with that. I want to eat a hot dog. I'd like to have sex with that. Give me a burger. I want a steak. I want sex. And that's what guys think. That's what guys want. So it's not that complex. I think they're going to work a little hard. I don't know. I feel sad for Taraji P. Henson because she's sort of getting locked into these early January releases that she really doesn't need to be. She's a much better actress than some of the crap that they're sending her away. The next one I want to hit, though, quickly is Widows, which opens on November 16th.
Something happened tonight, something bad. Mr. Mulligan, your family's been involved in Harry's life for many years. I need help.
I don't see what I can do.
Our husbands aren't coming back. We're on our own. My husband left me the plans for his next job. All I need is a crew to pull it off.
Why should we trust you anyway?
Because I'm the only one standing between you and a bullet in your head.
This one is directed by Steve McQueen, who, of course, did 12 Years a Slave and Shame. And this looks interesting. When I first heard the concept of Widows and I see it's a bunch of actors, I'm like, oh, it's just going to be them sitting around complaining. No, this actually looks like it's a hardcore gangster kind of movie. With the women who are left behind trying to do one final score. And that I actually think looks really interesting. I mean, Viola Davis is a fantastic actor. I still want to see her do a wacky comedy because I'd love to see her do comedy. But this looks like it's an interesting movie. It certainly seems out of the box and very different from 12 Years a Slave or Shame. So I'm curious to see Steve McQueen emerge as an action director. Or at the very least, you know, like something that you would expect something like David Ayers to direct or Peter Berg. And we'll talk about him later in the show. But yeah, I'm kind of looking forward to this one now. Anyways, that is it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to follow up on the movie The Meg because I gave it short shrift last week. You better think about what you're trying.
Burn out what it means to me. R-E-S-P-E.
Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump into the movie reviews. I'm actually going to do a late movie review here because I was gone last week. I actually went on vacation. I get some time off now and then. Now, there was a show last week, of course, and you listened to me talk about Black Klansman and that. But around that time, I also took a chunk of the week off. That's one of the reasons I missed the Meg. They screened it twice. I mean, they certainly put it out there. Warner Brothers had no problem getting that movie seen. And I respect the heck out of them for that. But I went on a cruise. And I've been on cruises before. This was my 10th cruise. And I'm not wealthy. I work in radio, for crying out loud. But I like cruising. I find that very fun. So my wife and I took my mother. I know, isn't that cheesy? I took my mom on a cruise. But she'd never been on a cruise, and she's of an advanced age. I will tell you this, if you're with somebody who has mobility issues, you do get put to the front of the line a lot. And we weren't like gaming that system. I know people will game that system like in Disneyland. People will basically hire somebody who's in a wheelchair to get them to the front of the line for the Disneyland rides, which that's not what we were doing. We were literally just trying to get my mom on a boat. Now, of course, we went to the Bahamas. And there's always the concern of sharks. And we're going to be talking about the Meg in this segment. And I think there was very little chance of a megalodon coming up out of the ocean and eating us. But there is the worry of sharks. I mean, sharks are real. Although shark attacks are so rare. Shark attacks do occur. But, I mean, you can count them on one hand or what's left of one hand. But I told my mom and my wife, I said I wouldn't worry about shark attacks because, Shark Week was last week. And all the sharks are taking some time off. They're relaxing. They're taking their own vacation because they're so busy because it's Shark Week. Who wants to work after Shark Week? It was interesting going on a cruise and swimming in the ocean while there was a major shark movie being released in the theaters. And I've done movies like Jaws. I remember when I was in college, they did what was called a Jaws swim along or something like that, where they showed Jaws in the pool. And that's kind of fun. I mean, it was a pool. I mean, it's a pool. There's very little chance of a great white shark attacking you in a pool. I remember reading that back when The Shallows came out. That's the one with Blake Lively where she's surfing and the great white boxers are in on the reef. There was like an actual live swim event in the ocean during that movie. I don't know if I could handle that. I don't know if I could go swim in the open ocean and watch a shark movie. That would just be too much. I would probably panic and drown. As it was, I carry my own flotation device. So I can usually float on the surface of the water without any assistance. That is my defense strategy. I can also go limp and not splash around like an animal in distress. So the sharks just go right by me and they go after the skinny swimmers that are trying to stay afloat because those idiots don't have any body fat on them. But because I was on the cruise, I didn't get to go see the Meg. And a loyal listener, Chris from Florida, wrote to me and said that last week's show was a Meg a tease. So bravo for that pun that my 10-year-old would love. Because I didn't really review it because I didn't see it. But I couldn't give it a preemptive suck because they screened it. I just, you know, I was on a boat. But right now I'm going to talk about the Meg. Let's talk about the Meg because I think it's worth mentioning because it made so much money last weekend. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. So in the Meg, you have Jason Statham versus a giant prehistoric shark from the deep. Boom.
What you people discovered is bigger than we ever thought possible.
How big is that thing?
It was the largest shark that ever existed.
A living fossil.
Thought to have been extinct over 2 million years.
Wrong.
My God.
It's a megalodon.
He's kidding, right?
A lot of people are comparing this movie to Jaws, obviously, because it's a giant shark. And Jaws itself, first of all, we have to understand, Jaws itself was a giant shark. Great white sharks grow to be 10. I think the biggest is like 12 or 14 feet, which is big. That's a significantly large shark. You do not want to encounter that shark in the wild. But Jaws, I think, was like 20 or more feet. Jaws was already physically larger than most great white sharks. But the Meg dwarfs all of that. The Meg, which is a prehistoric megalodon shark, which is essentially just there's some, the original consensus was that it was basically just a giant great white shark that was five times larger, but essentially anatomy wise it was kind of the same. And that's usually how you see megalodons represented in popular culture, for sure, but in artist renderings and that sort of thing. But there's some evidence that it may not have looked exactly like a great white shark. They don't quite know, because it's a lot of it just teeth, because there's not a whole lot of bones left, because sharks are cartilaginous creatures, so they don't leave skeletons very long, and certainly not for tens of millions of years. However, I would compare this movie a lot closer to Deep Blue Sea. That was the Rennie Harlan movie that came out in the 90s. That's the one where Samuel L. Jackson gets eaten in one of the best death scenes ever. We're not going to fight anymore. Chomp. And the reason I compare it to Deep Blue Sea, part of it is because Deep Blue Sea takes place in an underwater facility, and about half the movie does take place in an underwater facility. Jaws is a very different storyline. Jaws is a land-based movie about one guy trying to convince people that a monster is loose. That is what Jaws is. It's a monster movie at its heart, and it's a character study of these guys who go out. It's an allegory to Moby Dick. Of course, Ahab, represented by Quint in that movie. This one's very different. This is a little bit more of, like I said, Deep Blue Sea. This research team's fighting this shark, and the thing that works in this movie is it's Jason Statham. Let's just say it's Jason Statham is what works in this movie. Everybody else is dispensable, is disposable. It could be cast. Anybody else could have been cast in it, but Jason Statham makes it work because that's kind of the star power Jason Statham has, and more power to him. I mean, I think that's good for him. I mean, I'm not going to disparage Jason Statham for milking his career the way he has. Good for him. But the rest of the cast is sort of dispensable, and a lot of them are eaten, so that's okay. I mean, Rainn Wilson is in it. He's kind of funny as sort of the Elon Musk billionaire who's funding the research and development. But this is not a Jaws-type movie. This is also maybe a little bit more like Piranha, because, of course, it has the beach attack scene, which gets a little absurd because the megalodon is so large. It would be like a human being attacking an area that had Cheetos. You know, it's not exactly a big meal. It takes all the energy that it's going to digest out of a human being. It will take swimming to the next human being. That's the downfall of this movie, is megalodons were so huge, they ate whales and other giant sharks. So it just isn't worth them hunting humans. And so this one does get a little bit into that sort of Jaws 4 area where the shark's stalking them. And it's absurd, but it's fun. It's not as great as some people have said it is. I enjoyed it. I don't know if it was worth the money it made at the box office, but more power to them. Warner Brothers knew how to market this one. August is a good time for shark movies because we got The Shallows, and didn't we get 47 Meters Down last year about this time? Good shark movie's not bad, even when you're on a boat yourself in the middle of the ocean. So I'm still going to have to say my final rating on the Meg is It Kinda Rocks.
It Kinda Rocks.
That's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Alpha and Crazy Rich Asians. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews for new ones this week. And the first one I want to talk about is Alpha. In Europe, 20,000 years ago, a young man is left for dead during a prehistoric hunt and befriends a wolf that helps him make the journey home.
At the end of the last ice age, when our world was a harsh and unforgiving place, a boy who was separated from his family found a wolf separated from its pack.
I had seen posters for this for months, not knowing anything about it. I mean, yeah, I know I had an internet connection. I could have looked that up anytime, but who has time for that nonsense? This movie is very out of the box. And it's because of its out of the boxness that I have respect for it. It's essentially a prehistoric man movie. There was a movie 10,000 BC. It's way better than that. That thing was garbage. This is a good, solid attempt at tribalistic human culture. Takes place in Europe 20,000 years ago during the Ice Age, and they're doing a hunt, and they're hunting buffalo or sort of whatever the version of European buffalo was 20,000 years ago. It's not in English. It's in the tribal dialect, and in a lot of ways reminds me of Apocalypto, the Mel Gibson movie, which is about, I believe, the Mayans and the tribe, a tribe of people that get kind of caught up in the Mayan slaughtering of people. And so this movie, there's no English in it whatsoever, which I think is kind of a bold choice. Now, it's directed by Albert Hughes, who's best known for being one half of the Hughes brothers. They don't work together anymore. I think the last movie they did together was The Book of Eli. Denzel Washington trying to bring a Bible to one place or the other. They've also cut their teeth doing hardcore gangster films like Menace to Society and Dead Presidents back in the 90s. I respect the heck out of Albert Hughes for making a movie like this, because this is not a movie that's an easy sell, because it's very low on dialogue, and what dialogue it is it's in a tribal dialect and it uses subtitles. But it is a beautiful looking movie. It is this cross between an Ice Age film and 300, because it has in the action sequences, you know, the slow motion shot, these wide, impressive, ramping shots, and it looks beautiful. It looks gorgeous. It does take a while to get through. It's like I said, it's not a fast moving film, but it's an attempt to show what would have been the early bonding between humans and wolves. And this is the start of the species Canis familiaris, which would be the standard domesticated dog. In that sense, it's really interesting. And for a dog lover, it's kind of cool. I would not say, hey, because it's got a dog on the poster, or a wolf, actually. But because it has a what looks like a dog on the poster does not mean that it's a boy and his dog kind of movie. Do not bring a five-year-old to this. More, they're going to get bored than they are going to be shocked and traumatized by it, although it does have some violence to it. It's about tribal hunting and saber-toothed cats attacking people. So in terms of sort of that prehistoric movie, I actually enjoyed it more than I thought I would. Like I said, I went in not knowing anything about it, and it kept my interest. So I have to say that overall, while it's not perfect, it has some slow parts, and I'm not totally sold on Cody Smith McPhee, who plays the main character, but I think he does a fine job. The dog's cute, or the wolf. So ultimately, I'm going to have to say this one kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Crazy Rich Asians. And by that, I mean the movie, not actual people. This Cinderella romance follows an average Chinese-American woman who falls in love with a man who happens to be super-duper wealthy. And he takes her to Singapore to meet his family.
Rich, we've been dating for over a year now, and I think it's about time people met my beautiful girlfriend. What about us taking an adventure east?
Like Queens?
Singapore, Colin's wedding. Don't you want to be my family?
I hardly know anything about them. Every time I bring them up, Nick changes the subject.
The Nick you're dating is Nick Young?
Yeah, you guys know them or something?
I chose to raise a family. For me, it was a privilege. But for you, you may think it's old-fashioned.
Don't you want Nick to be happy?
I know you're not what Nick needs.
There's two ways to look at this movie. On one hand, you can just look at it as a rom-com, and that's really what it is. And when you boil it down to it, it's the Cinderella story. It's a romantic comedy. It's something that you can go to on date night. It's something that you can go to with girls' night out. It's a cute movie. It's a sweet little romance. The guy's a good guy. Nothing really wrong with him. It's not complex in terms of their relationship. And it follows that standard pattern of the outsider trying to win approval of the family and of the people. And she doesn't just have to win approval because she's from a lower class of citizen. And by say that, by lower class, I don't mean she's poor. She's not like a bike messenger or something like that. She's a professor at like NYU. So that's poor compared to the super crazy rich Asians that she goes to see, because they live in like a $200 million mansion. But overall, she comes from a lower socioeconomic level, and her mom is kind of a nobody. So she doesn't have any sort of money or fame or status behind her. But she also has to cross the cultural barriers, because even though she's of Chinese descent, she's Chinese American, she's Chinese American. And the American hyphenation can get issues with sort of the old country or the other country where everyone comes from. The Chinese and the Chinese descent from Singapore in the movie are looked down on her because they're like, well, you buck tradition, you do whatever you want to, which is, first of all, that's not anything that's limited to just Asian cultures. That's everywhere. You watch any movie about somebody from America facing their family back home in Ireland or their family back home in Italy. Any of these famous immigrant movies are like, oh, don't just chase your dreams. You have to do family and work with people. Even a movie like Coco, which is about Mexico, does deal with the family first issue of not leaving the home and supporting the family, which is, while Americans support the family, there is a chase your dream attitude in America that is a stumbling block in this movie. For her, in terms of their relationship. So as a rom-com, it totally works. It's sweet. It's adorable. It's a beautiful looking movie. It's very vibrant and colorful. It's absurd at times. And it does kind of have that, gee, isn't it nice to be wealthy attitude? Because like, there's even a scene where she gets upset and she leaves the mansion. She goes to her friend's house who lives in another opulent house. It's not a $200 million mansion, but it has a gate. It has a fountain. It has gold on the walls. So there's that. But the other reason that it's making a lot of news is because it's, I believe, the first studio produced, not acquired, but studio produced film featuring a majority Asian American cast or Asian cast since like the Joy Luck Club. And there's something to be said for people want to see themselves represented in movies. Even if it's not them exactly, they want to see their race represented in movies. That's one of the reasons why the Fast and Furious movies do so well across the board, is because it's a diverse cast and it's a diverse world. Now, if you're looking for Asians represented in movies, there's an entire continent of filmmakers making movies that are just about Asians. It's the Chinese cinema, Hong Kong cinema, Japanese cinema, Korean cinema. But those are Korean or Japanese or Chinese. This is Asian American, and there's a difference. And I think it's significant, but I wouldn't put too much weight on that, because then you're making it, that's the reason that it's doing well. And I think it's going to do well because it's a nice romantic comedy. And if you overstate it, then they're going to say, well, we'll make another movie like this, and it may not be a good movie, and the Asian Americans don't go see it because it's not that good, not because it doesn't have them in them. And then they're going to be like, oh, no more Asian American movies. You know, it's the same thing with Black Panther. Black Panther certainly got a huge boost because it was the first major black superhero that got his own movie in the Marvel Universe. But it was also a really good movie. It would not have made as much money if it wasn't that good. And take that all with a grain of salt, with the big fat white guy talking about cultural significance, because what the heck do I know? But still, ultimately, I'm going to have to say Crazy Rich Asians kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to review Mile 22, talk about the box office, and the home cinema roundup featuring Avengers Infinity War. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on and finalize the movie reviews with Mile 22. An elite government squad must transport a political prisoner through a hostile country to the airport to extradite him in order to get information on weapons of mass destruction.
According to the government, we do not exist, but we're very real.
We're unpredictable, highly trained,
and we save millions of lives. If we fail, there is no backup plan. We are Overwatch, and we get things done.
My government is planning an attack on the United States.
Can I trust you?
Put me on a plane and I'll give you everything.
Deliver that package
22 here. Mile 22.
It's not uncommon for Mark Wahlberg to have an action movie coming out in either January or August. I remember he would do that periodically. I can't remember all of the movies he's been in, but he's been in a whole bunch of them that were just these throw-off action movies. Once he started doing like the Transformer films, he's always been kind of a movie star for years, but those were the ones that kind of propelled him to the blockbuster status. But he was sort of like, for a while there, like Liam Neeson, where he could do these sort of gritty action movies. And they'd be just these one-offs, and he had his own little cottage industry. And that's essentially what they're trying to do here with this movie. Now, it's directed by Peter Berg. And Peter Berg has done some big movies that have been bombastic and stupid, like Battleship. And he's done more realistic, specific movies like Lone Survivor or Friday Night Lights. A lot of people know him from that. I'm not a big Peter Berg fan. I do not think he's a great director. I think some of his movies are good. I thought Lone Survivor was fine for what it was. I think that he's always been kind of a Michael Bay wannabe, and that is evidenced by him making Battleship, which was a Hasbro property that he wanted to turn into a big bombastic action franchise, and it didn't. But I'm just not a huge fan of Berg's movies. He's done the more pragmatic, realistic movies. Like, he did that one about the Boston Marathon bombing. He did that movie, The Kingdom, which was about terrorism and fighting the war on terror in the Middle East. So he's done some significant work, and I think that's his better stuff. This one is still just a big, stupid, bombastic movie that's just sort of disguised as a more serious one. But it's not anything real, and it is loud. And the action's not even good, because there's some action scenes that are decent, but there's other action scenes that there's a whole scene where they're like in the building. They're in a building. They're in like a hallway complex, and they're in there for like 20 minutes. I don't know if it's 20 minutes, but they're in there for a long time, and it's boring. And I'm like, get out of there. And it's not a good, vibrant action movie. It's murky, it's hard to see, and yeah, you got explosions, and on one hand, he's making these explosions like more realistic explosions with less big fireballs, even though he has those fireball explosions in there, but it might be more realistic of what action movies look like, but it doesn't hold a candle to stuff like Atomic Blonde when they were doing action scenes in that in sort of these close quarters. But the biggest problem I had with it is there are no good guys in this movie. Even the good guys aren't good guys. They're awful people. It reminds me a little bit of that movie. I believe it was Sabotage that had Schwarzenegger trying to make his return to movies after his governor of California term was over. And it was directed by David Ayers, I believe. And this movie was about this SWAT team or this elite team. And everybody was awful. Everybody was corrupt, and everybody was a jerk. And I didn't feel anything for the characters. That was my problem with that movie. That's my problem with this movie. Mile 22. I don't care about anybody. Yeah, they're supposed to be saving millions of people from a terrorist attack, but they're just a-holes to everybody and to each other. I have a lot of trouble watching a movie and getting behind characters that are supposed to be the heroes or the good guys, but you just don't like them. And it's not just because they're at their core murderers, because that's what their job. They go in and they have to kill people. I can rationalize that. It's just they seem like jerks. But even more than that, half this movie is Mark Wahlberg monologuing. He constantly is talking, and he's giving speech after speech after speech. It's so bad that an hour into the film, John Malkovich's character literally says to him, quit monologuing. And then Malkovich's character proceeds to monologue for about 5 minutes about nonsense. This is one of the most overwritten, under-enthusiastic films I've seen this year. I did not have a good time. Mile 22 totally sucks.
It sucks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the box office really quick. It was a big deal last week for The Meg. The Meg did extremely well. It exceeded expectations, $45 million over the weekend, which is fantastic for an opening weekend in August. Now, granted, it's not at the level of like the first Guardians of the Galaxy or Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, but for just a stupid, dumb shark movie, $45 million is pretty doggone good, especially when the only star behind it you have is Jason Statham, who's not like consistently delivering $40, $50 million opening weekends. The star of this was Jason Statham, absolutely, but the star of it was also the Megalodon. And that's good for the film. I mean, good for this movie. We're going to get a sequel. You know we're going to get a sequel. This movie's going to top off with over $100 million. Of course it's going to get a sequel. I mean, the budget was over $100 million, but once you throw in international box office and the fact that it has well-known Chinese actors in it, that's going to help. And it's set partly in Asia there. So there's a reason that they do this. It's not just Crazy Rich Asians that are casting Asians and Asian Americans. The other movies around, that's why in like, the Independence Day sequel, that's why they cast a Chinese star from Chinese movies into the movie that nobody in America recognized. That's how Hollywood works now, because China is a huge market for this stuff. Mission Impossible's doing well. Christopher Robin's still out there doing pretty decently. Slender Man, I mean, for its low budget, it did fine. It was like about $11 million. And Black Klansman made just under $11 million. And again, off a $15 million budget, that's great. And this thing's going to live through award season. So keep your eye on that one. And then outside of the top 10 was Dog Days. Nobody expected that to do very well. It made just a couple million. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. The big movie this week on DVD and Blu-ray is finally Avengers Infinity War is available for home viewing. Now, it's been as on demand. It's been one you could get streaming for a couple weeks, but now you can get the Blu-ray, which has the bonus features, and that's really the reason to see it. Thanos is coming, and it's up to the heroes in the Marvel Universe to stop him from utilizing the Infinity Gauntlet.
The entire time I knew him, he only ever had one goal. To wipe out half the universe. If he gets all the Infinity Stones, he can do it with the snap of his fingers.
Tell me his name again.
Thanos.
We have what Thanos wants, so that's what we use.
There's not a whole lot more I can say about this film. It's a well-done movie. It is definitely worth the coming together of all the Marvel characters. It certainly juggles them a lot better than Avengers Age of Ultron. That one was scattered everywhere. Here they got most of the characters back, and they do really well working with each other. And the Russo brothers are able to bounce around storylines from all the different movies, everything from Guardians of the Galaxy to Thor to Captain America to Tony Stark. So you have all these different characters that are spread very thinly through the movie, but they treat it more as vignettes, and it's Thanos' movie. He's the one who's got the overreaching arc. I don't want to say too much because, I mean, I'm assuming most people have seen it, but if you haven't, still worth checking out on DVD and Blu-ray. And the bonus features aren't spectacular. There's some good stuff. There's a handful of featurettes that's always nice to have, and deleted scenes. And of course, an audio commentary, which is always worth listening to. And that adds quality to the disc because you can watch it twice, which is like 5 hours of footage now because the movie itself is 2.5. And then of course, the gag reel, always fun. The gag reel in the Marvel films. There could be a little bit more stuff on there, but that's okay. I imagine when they finally do the next Avengers movies, there's going to be like a 2-pack that's going to be this like collector's edition with both films and even more bonus features. But we still have to wait till next summer. This book ended the summer, beginning of the summer, or opened the end of the summer. You've got the Blu-ray. This has been an Avengers summer, and it's one of Marvel's biggest years. Still sticking with my review of Avengers Infinity War, that it rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
Other releases this week include How to Talk to Girls at Parties, plus re-releases of Return of the Living Dead and The Unborn from Screen Factory. I'm going to take a little more time next week to talk about both of those because I think they're worth getting into and showing a little bit of love for some early Halloween horror movie watching. But that is it for the show. I need to go. When I come back next week, I'm going to be talking about The Happy Time Murders and AXL. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.